Hello and welcome. I'm Alec Hogg. What a year we've had. 2025 drawing to a close. Well, as certainly as far as the editor's desk is concerned. Today is the 18th of December, Thursday the 18th of December, and this is our final episode of the editor's desk for the year. Glad to have you with me. The Editor's Desk is a relatively new addition to the BizNews stable of podcasts, and the reaction we've had has been very good. It's for BizNews Premium members only, and it's the place that I take you into my confidence and give you more insights into what's happening behind the scenes, my own views on latest developments, and more particularly, what all of this means for your money. We're going to be closing off today and back again in early January, but I look forward to continuing with the experiment, I guess, that it was so far into 2026 and serving you as before. Well, a couple of biggies to end the year with, and I'm going to start off with the latest report from Chwani. Now, let me put this into some kind of context. The Stock Exchange News Service is an interesting vehicle for information. Often there is a lot of highly arcane info that many financial journalists actually just don't even understand. And the problem for this, or the reason for this, is that many people who are financial journalists were kind of kicked there by the editors who in the past said, well, we got someone who's covering news, which is most people are at, the courts, politics, crime. Damn it, we need someone on finance. You look like a likely lad. Why don't you go along there? So the result of this is that many financial journalists kind of find themselves there. They're not necessarily that passionate about it. And the thing that keeps bugging me is that they do not understand the language of business and economics, which is accounting. So if you don't have a basis of information, it's like, to me, it's like going into France and opening a restaurant and you're an English speaker and you do not speak French. You'll find it very difficult to understand what's going on around you. It might take you years to actually get to that point. That is very much the situation with financial journalism in South Africa, in that so much of the language is not understood by those who are doing the reporting of it. So that's my own personal bugbear, and it's something that I've seen play out time and time and time again. But anyway, the Stock Exchange News Service is a place where companies have to publish anything that is price sensitive. And that is where most of the focus is on the companies. But it's not just companies that the JSC covers. It also has a very active bond market. And for those who don't understand or haven't been exposed to bonds, I was very lucky. My very first job in financial journalism was to cover the primary and secondary bond market, or gilt and semi-gilts, as they were then called. I mean, really, Penelope Gracie, who was my editor, dropped me in the deep end there. And it was very much a question of think or swim. And I'm eternally grateful to some of the wonderful people from that time. Colin Dunn, who was at a place called the Discount House of South Africa. It's ancient history. Dave van Rienen, who was with Matheson and Hollidge, who were the first stockbroker to really get involved in making a secondary market out of bonds, and others of the ilk, who took me to long lunches and explained things to me, so that this little guy who came from Newcastle in the very rural KZN, very much the outback, was able to understand slowly what was going on in this bond market. And I'm eternally grateful to them. Sandro Buzacchi, another man that I remember so well. He was the treasurer at then Barclays Bank, which is now First Rand or First National Bank. they were so passionate about what they did, and they explained to me that the bond market is where the real action happens. When people trade in the bond market, or when institutions trade in the bond market, individuals don't really, they're dealing in huge amounts of money. It's tens of millions, often hundreds of millions per trade. Anyway, the JSE has got the bond market, and on the bond market in South Africa, it is dominated by RSA stock or government stock, but also there is a pretty active market for metros. So you'll have Cape Town, Johannesburg, Tshwane, Durban, and it's a very good place to watch the credit ratings of those metros. But more than that, the metros themselves are forced to provide information in the same way as a company's got to provide information to its shareholders. In other words, on the bond market, your counterparty are investors, and those investors are highly sophisticated. They're dealing in, as I mentioned earlier, trades of kind of 10 to 100 million and even more. And so they make a small mistake on that by not having analyzed the information. Well, they're in for the high jump because it's big numbers that you're dealing with. Okay, so a guy like Andrew Cantor, for instance, at Future Growth, is an expert on the bond market, not just on these metros, but then you get Eskom stock as well, which is a huge part. After RSA stock, after government stock, Eskom is the next there, and you get Transnet stock. And it's good to watch how the credit ratings or how the interest rates on these stocks trade, and that gives you an idea of the credit rating. Yesterday, we had a release onto the Stock Exchange News Service from Tshwane. Now, this is particularly interesting because it's not that long ago that the mayor, the executive mayor of Tshwane, Celia Brunk, was hoofed out of his position when Action SA, which is the party founded by Herman Mashaba, who hails from Tshwane, Action SA decided to abandon its partnership, its alliance with the Democratic Alliance, and took its votes across to the ANC. So Celia Brunk, who had gone into that post in the, well, I suppose, the confident belief that they would be able to fix up Tshwane, because there's no argument that it has been massively badly managed by the ANC. So it was a belief that they would have time to fix it. Well, they didn't have time anymore. And Action SA went across. And since then, we've had this war of words, where on the one side, Celia Brinks tells us that they are badly mismanaging Tshwane, that a lot of what he put in place was now being unraveled. And as a consequence of that, he says that in the elections next year, November next year, please vote for the DAs and give them 50% so that they can go in and do the job properly to fix Tshwane. On the other hand, you've got Herman Mashaba and the guys from Action SA saying their new mayor that was the deal. So they did the deal with the ANC, and then they got to appoint the mayor. So their mayor is such a fantastic person, and she's doing a wonderful job, and they are making massive strides, and barely a day goes by on social media where when you have a look at it, you will believe that from their reports that they're going to have a landslide victory next year because they have done so well. And one of the points here is a place called Hammanskraal. And Hammanskraal is quite important in the context of the story because that's where Herman Mashaba comes from. Anyway, so the story this morning has been, we've been able to separate at last the noise from reality. And the reality is not what Action SA and Co. are trying to paint it. Certainly not even close to it. Because if you read on the Stock Exchange News Service, the latest numbers to come out of Tshwane and to come out from of the balance sheet of Tshwane, because the balance sheet gives you the actual information, not the noise, what we call the signal. The real signals are in the balance sheet. It's in the financial statements. It's in the language of accounting, which has got no room for, well, there's creative accounting, but generally speaking, numbers don't lie. And the signal comes out and it says, Trani is in deep, deep trouble. The noise that's been spun has really been creating a narrative that actually isn't true. So what does, where do we get this from? The city of Trani, like all other public sector entities, is audited by the Auditor General of South Africa. It's a statutory body that's based in Trani, in Pretoria, and it is responsible for all of those assessments. In the same way as in the private sector, you'd have Deloitte and PwC and Ernst & Young and KPMG and BDO and all of those accounting firms and smaller accounting firms, I guess, as well, who audit the public companies. And so investors in public companies or those who hold the debt of public companies can make a proper assessment because you've got a professional, you've got professionals looking after them. Okay. So I hope that all of this makes sense. At the moment, so the Auditor General then audits Trani and it says, Trani is in, well, it's in deep trouble. There is a 4.3 billion rand shortfall, and that is unaccounted for, and that's why the Auditor General has issued a qualified audit opinion. Now, if you're a company listed on the stock exchange and you get a qualified audit opinion, usually what happens, the share price plummets and executives get their heads chopped off, because that's one thing you just cannot have. Those 4.3 billion rands in contingencies, funds that should have been set aside for future liabilities, aren't there. They've been understated. So there's a 4.3 billion rand hole in the accounts. That's essentially what's happening. And a big part of this is what's going on operationally. Trani's water, roughly 40% of what it buys is disappearing. So 40% of what Trani or the municipality buys is being lost either through aging pipes, but generally speaking, because of theft, unbilled consumption, inaccurate metering, and, other euphemisms for corruption. Electricity is hardly better. The Auditor General says that Trani lost 1.87 billion rand from its electricity purchases, not actually being sold on. So imagine you're buying goods for nearly 2 billion rand of your total purchases, about 20% of the total purchases, and that's not being unsold. That's just disappearing. And again, it's theft, tampering, illegal connections, and so on. That is not what you would like to see happening if you're living in the city. But it gets worse, and particularly for Herman Mashaba, because the Rooivaal wastewater treatment, which has created a health crisis in Hammanskraal, has been highlighted by the Attorney General as a material irregularity. So we got the full story on BizNews. I propose that you go and read through it. But in essence, this is not a good picture for those who've been saying that the Trani change in government has been for the better. It looks decidedly not. It looks like it was for the worse. Thank heavens that we do have some kind of an audit here in South Africa, and thank heavens that the Auditor General has remained independent. You know, quite often we talk about these adults in the room in the South African governance setup being the South African Reserve Bank and the Treasury and SARS. Well, SARS, now that it's been uncaptured after the capture by the Zuma administration and well, the people they put in there, supported along the road by KPMG and McKinsey, and what a dreadful time our country went through there. But another adult in the room unquestionably is the Auditor General, and the Auditor General does as good a job in telling us about what's going on with the state enterprises and the public sector as the big four audit firms do in the private sector. And when you've got that in place, you've got to believe that at some point in time, the impact of that is going to be felt in the economy generally. And that's why I remain so excited about South Africa, because I'm seeing from my vantage point that this impact is going in the right direction. Okay, well, it's quite a long conversation today because I'm going to take you into a story that I don't think I've ever told before on the investment side. And here it is to do with the late Brian Gilbertson. Gilbertson passed away yesterday. Gilbertson was an absolute giant on the South African global sense. And we have got a obituary to Brian Gilbertson. He was 82 years old. He lived, while I lived in Johannesburg, he lived up the road. I was in Parkview, which is kind of in the valley. And up on the hill, you have the wealthy guys lived in Westcliff. And he was a resident of Pallinghurst Road, the best road in Westcliff. And he lived there for many years. He passed away at his home. I don't know if that was in Westcliff or elsewhere, after a long illness. Gilbertson, I had the privilege of meeting him a few times. I can remember having a lunch at the Billiton head office. It was one of those press lunches. Didn't have them often for editors. And sitting opposite him and having a fascinating conversation with him about where he believed that mining should go to, that they should be looking at the highest quality assets with the lowest possible cost, even though at the time of the lunch, I recall so strongly, the prices were much higher. And of course, commodities move in cycles. And Gilbertson had that ability to see way beyond where other people saw. He then put together the deal with BHP, and he was the chief executive of BHP Billiton. He was the relocated to Melbourne, where their head office was based. And I actually visited, not him, but I visited the BHP offices in Melbourne during a trip to Australia while Gilbertson was in the hot seat there. He resigned, though, in 2003. And at the time, it was quite a surprise when he left. It seemed a little strange. He'd only been running the place for 2 years. And I suppose the obvious conclusion for most of us was, well, the Aussies didn't want a South African, didn't want Gilbertson, who was a forceful fella. There's a famous story about him on how he used to like to fly into his offices by helicopter. That was when Glencore, which he was the CEO, which became Billiton and then BHP Billiton, Glencore had an office in downtown, and they used to, in the Glencore building, they would say when Gilbertson's helicopter landed, the ego has landed, a play on a movie called The Eagle Has Landed. Anyway, apparently Billiton certainly did not lack confidence. But where this story all goes to was that after he left BHP Billiton and I was running Moneyweb, and we had a guy who worked for us in Russia. He was based in Moscow. And he wrote a series of not very well read but highly scurrilous articles on a oligarch from Georgia called Generalov. Now, I remember the names because they cost me a lot of money. And these articles, I always felt that the correspondent that we had there, his name was Dr. John Helmer, an Australian, always felt that he was reputable. He had came highly recommended by one of the guys who worked for us, the late Jim Jones. It's another story. I won't get into it now. Had I known then what I know now, I would have been a lot more skeptical about Jones's recommendations, but it is what it is. And Helmer covered Russia for us, for MindWeb, which was really an international part, an international arm of the business. And these articles that he wrote about Generalov, I looked at them and I thought, this is strange. And I asked him, you know, what's going on here? And he said, no, this guy's a bad guy and he's doing really bad things. Anyway, Generalov decided that he would sue us. And he decided he would sue us in London. And it was the opening bid was going to cost us more than the whole market cap of MoneyWeb. And remember, MoneyWeb was listed on the stock market at the time. So I, after initially, Helmer pointed me towards some libel lawyers in London. I got hold of them and I asked them what the situation was. And the libel lawyers said to me, there was we didn't have a case to answer. And so I thought, oh, okay, well, goodbye, Generalov. You know, go and jump in the lake. And literally, these were very poorly read stories. They must have been read, I don't know, 200, 300 people had read them in total. But they were on MindWeb and they were on the internet, written by John Helmer. And I had no reason to believe that Helmer wasn't this absolute superstar journalist, who he may well be. I'm not sure. Maybe he just made a mistake here. But this is what I do know. I then eventually met with Helmer in London. He assured me that his story was absolutely correct. He assured me that the lawyers were completely correct. And I then got a hold of the lawyers again about 3 months down the line, because initially they said to us, we need to put £10,000 into the account. And already this was significant money over your South African company. And after I then got hold of them again, they said, no, they need £100,000 in the account, which is over R1 million. And I thought, wow, this is starting to get really serious for a couple of stories that not too many people have read. And I said to them at that point, what are the it's fine, I don't mind doing it, but I need to know what the chances are of this being thrown out of court. And they said, well, 50-50. So suddenly from no case to answer, it was 50-50. So the consequence of that was that I decided that we were not going to go to court. We then reached out to Generalov. We wanted to hear what his settlement was. He was actually very generous in the end of the day. He was prepared for us to publish an apology and to put I think it was R150,000, which was quite a lot of money, but into a charity so that we wouldn't do something naughty like this again. And the charity that he was happy to put it into was the one named after my late son. So he was happy to do that. So I think, from everything that I got, he was a fairly reasonable guy. Helmer, on the other hand, still maintained his innocence, but we decided in the wake of this that perhaps it would have been better, given that Russia was a relatively small part of our coverage anyway, to stop using his material. And I told him that and I explained it to him. I hope he understood. But here's where the story gets really interesting. And I remember it so well. I was back in those days, I used to take every 3 months or so with three of my friends. We would go to some place in the country for a weekend of golf. That was like our big breakaway, to get out of Joburg, to decompress. And I was driving from the airport in George to Fancourt. I remember it so well. And the phone rang and it said Brian Gilbertson. I thought, gee, this is unusual. Pulled the car off the road and Brian Gilbertson explained to me in no uncertain terms why I was wrong to let John Helmer go. And I said, but Brian, we don't get a heck of a lot from Russia. And actually, he had a go at one of Putin's enemies. And it doesn't leave a very good taste in one's mouth on all of this. And Brian said, well, it doesn't matter. I will pay you to re-employ Helmer. I will pay everything that we'll set up a section, if you like, and we'll sponsor it. At the time, Gilbertson was involved with Ruzal, which was a Russian company. I declined the generous offer and, we carried on. And that's the last time I spoke to him. So it's interesting, isn't it, that you have different recollections of people. And we know that as journalists, we only get to see the outside often of the onion. And it's only as the layers of the onion get unpeeled that we get to understand a little better what's behind it. I don't know whether Gilbertson was close to Putin, whether Putin's a good guy and Gilbertson was also a good guy. I really don't know if Generalov was the bad guy in this whole situation. And I'll leave that to your own judgment. My judgment is on this, is just to go back to what Socrates always preached, and that was we know nothing. We start from the basis that we know nothing. We can share information, as we should, but we really must not prejudge and not take an opinion on this. But what I do know was that that whole episode costs our company a lot of money in legal fees, and it could have cost us the whole company had we not stopped and taken the decision that sometimes it's best to walk away than it is to, and to know that you really don't know anything, than it is to fight on some kind of a principle where you don't really have all the facts. Interesting. Okay, well, as I said earlier, this was a bit of a longer editor's desk, and I hope that it fills you with more questions and more thoughts and more maybe insights of your own into things that happened in the past that you weren't always entirely sure why they happened or what the connections were. And that I hope that you have a fantastic festive season. We are going to have a wonderful Christmas. We're knocking off here. Tomorrow is our last day. There will be articles published, fresh pieces published on BizNews right through the festive season. Our team have picked up the best of for the year. So there's lots to consume. And we'll be keeping an eye on you. Have to in the news business. You can't just ignore. You can't say that the world stops for 2 weeks because we're on holiday. But we will be keeping an eye on what is happening. And if there is something that you need to know, rest assured we will let you know. But we'll be back with Editor's Desk in January. And as mentioned at the outset, thank you so much for being with us for another year. Our 12th at BizNews, and as 13 is my lucky number, yo, can't wait for 2026. I'm going to leave it there for today. Keep your eye on the premium newsletter for links to our freshest published content. Thanks for trusting us with your time. I'm Alec Hogg. Until January, cheerio.